We've heard of poet laureates, but what is a drag laureate?
The job description starts with be fabulous all the time. It also is an important part of representing San Francisco and our values for inclusion.
On this edition of Out in the Bay, meet the world's first drag laureate. Darcy Drollinger tells us how she crafted this new role in her first year. We hear some of her drag performances.
Midnight Enterprises owns a patent for shoulder pads, a multi-billion dollar industry, and one of the most important fashion innovations in history. You, Cassandra, hold the patent for the crotchless thong.
And we discuss the intense politics around drag. Why has it become such a cultural flashpoint? I'm Eric Jansen. Stay with us. On this edition, a very special guest.
Champagne, Horowitz, Jones, Dickerson White. So I've been married a couple of times. It's none of your f***ing business.
That's the voice of Darcy Drollinger, San Francisco's and the world's first drag laureate. Champagne White, a strip, exotic dancer, is one of many characters Darcy has created over the years. We'll hear more from Champagne, and we'll hear a lot more from drag laureate Darcy Drollinger as she nears 1 year in this official role, including what makes drag fun and its impact on society and politics, especially in this presidential election year. Darcy is a longtime drag performer, writer, actor, director, and producer, and for almost a decade now, owner and operator of San Francisco's Oasis Nightclub and Cabaret, a mecca for queer entertainment. He, and we'll get to the pronoun bit later, has also played the lead role of Dr. Frankenfurter in Ray of Light Theater Company's live onstage Rocky Horror Show for the past several years, the last two at Oasis as an immersive co-production. Darcy has appeared on Out in the Bay a few times before. I believe the first was 2012 or so, soon after his return to San Francisco from New York, when he spoke with us about Project Lohan, a complex theater piece about the trials and tribulations of Lindsay Lohan. Darcy Drollinger, thanks for coming back to tell Out in the Bay listeners about the fascinating new role of drag laureate and talk with us about the politics of drag.
Thank you very much for having me. It's good to be here.
It's been about a year now into your drag laureate term. You were appointed in mid-May 2023. So briefly, how has this first year been for you?
I mean, it's a very daunting task to take something on for the very first time, but also very exciting. You get to sort of carve it out and create the role. So it has been everything I thought it was going to be and much, much more. I was not expecting how much national and international press was going to come my way due to the fact, you know, that what was happening in Tennessee and in other states around the country in terms of working hard to ban drag and take away queer and trans rights. So it was, I was thrust in the spotlight a little harder than I expected.
I do remember you saying at the time that you found it fantastic and a little terrifying.
Yes.
We will get into those politics more a bit later, but before we do that, I want to dive into some of the joy of drag, its entertainment value. So let's start with more of that scene from your stage show and film, the name of which I can't say on the radio, so I'll have to say SH blank T and Champagne. Champagne's an exotic dancer. In the first few minutes, her boyfriend's shot. She wants to fight his killer, yet she is brought in for questioning. At the cop shop, Detective Jack Hammer, played by Seton Brown, interrogates her.
Legal name?
Champagne White.
Full legal name.
What are you driving at?
You reek of divorce.
Yeah, well, you reek of cheap whiskey and Vaseline, but I'm not sticking it in no report.
Here's a news flash. Lose the attitude or I'm throwing you in solitary. Now, what's your full legal name?
Champagne, Horowitz, Jones, Dickerson White. So I've been married a couple of times. It's none of your f***ing business.
Darcy, how did this character come to you?
Well, I had been working so hard at creating these other shows for other people. I wanted to write something that was for me and that I knew could speak to my strengths. And she was not only that ball-busting, tough-talking dame, but she could pivot into this sort of innocent coquette. And she's very much Miss Piggy in human form, and the fact that her emotions move so quickly. I think I was very much inspired by sort of the exploitation films of the 70s, the Pam Grier films, you know, Coffee and Foxy Brown, also Savage Streets and those kind of films, but also very much inspired by 70s television icons like Wonder Woman, The Bionic Woman, Charlie's Angels. And so I took both of those as inspirations and then put them sort of in a world of Mel Brooks and then stuck in some Quentin Tarantino action scenes. And it came out in this really fun, unique way that I started as a stage play, but I did it as if we were reenacting a film. So I put in all the Foley of every footstep and every punch and kick. And so it very much had this cinematic aspect to the live show that I think is partially what made it so fun, but also made it much easier to translate into film because a lot of that had already been done for the stage show, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does, of course. And what part of your own personality is in Champagne?
Well, you know, I mean, she's everything that I'm not in a lot of ways. And so it makes it really fun for me to be able to portray that on stage. And, you know, I've lived with this character for so many years at this point that she's, you know, I can turn her on in a second. And interesting enough, we originally, I couldn't get anyone to produce the show, partially because of the name.
The film, or you mean the
stage show? I couldn't get anyone to let me. I was living in New York at the time, and I just got no after no after no. And I think a lot of people wouldn't even read the script because of the title. And I look back on it and wonder if I should have just had a different title. But I stuck with it. And I ended up finding a strip club that would let me put the show on before the strippers came in at 10 o'clock. And
fantastic.
So it sort of made sense. And it was not the fanciest of strip clubs. There were 4 dimmer switches. That was all the lights were. You know, someone had to sit backstage and take a pencil to push them all down at the same time to get a blackout. And the dressing room was tiny, tiny. But we did it. It was a ramshackle. And it ran for a long time. And I kind of never thought I would do it again. But then when I came back to San Francisco, the opportunity presented itself. And it became a runaway hit here. And it sort of the blossoming of that play really sort of set the stage for everything from Oasis to the 2 sequels to the film. It was an important part of my trajectory for sure.
Without giving too much away, and just briefly, can you explain the title SH blank T in Champagne, what that refers to?
Well, you know, if anyone's watched those old exploitation films of the 70s, oftentimes they... the plot is this, you know, drug ring or crime ring gets people addicted, or the girls addicted to heroin, and then enlists them into prostitution rings. And it felt rather a little rough trying to make a comedy about shooting heroin, right? So I was reading in the paper in the Village Voice that Michael Mousteau had written an article about how the plumbing in most of the nightclubs during this time was all falling apart, and the toilets were overflowing. And it turns out that it was a big trend to do booty bumps, which was shooting crystal meth up your butt, and then everyone was going to the bathroom in their pants, having to flush their underwear down the toilet. And anyway, I didn't go that deep in my show, but I thought, what a funny.
But there are some scenes with white jeans.
White jeans. Well, I couldn't not, right? I had to be there. But it's tamer than a John Waters film, I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I think that's true. Okay, so anyway, let's move on. How did drag come to you, or you to it? I mean, at what age did you first do drag?
Well, I think I was doing drag since I was about 3 years old. I was obsessed with Mary Poppins and wanted very much to dress up like Mary Poppins. And my mother took me to a thrift store and we got a dress and some high heels and an umbrella. And I ran around the house. And
that's so intense. They were supportive.
My parents are incredibly supportive. They're both professors and they're both artists, and they're both very great intellectual minds, and they just very open minds and open hearts. And so it's you know, they've always marched the beat of their own drum, which at times in my life, I was a little kid, and it was a little embarrassing having such sort of quiet but eccentric parents. And I look back on it now and I realize how lucky I was. And so, you know, it was something there in my life that, you know, it wasn't something I did all the time necessarily, but something that I felt like I immediately knew I was good at, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and you could have fun with it.
And, you know, it was something that I did sort of for fun. And I started, you know, I've written many plays and musicals, and I would start writing myself characters from time to time. A lot of times I wouldn't be in my shows, but if I was, I'd write myself a character that could at least partially be in drag. But it wasn't until opening Oasis where I really had to make that decision to be like, this is going to be my full-time job. That's the moment where I've really come to terms with not having a drag name, for example, and what that meant walking through the world using the same name in and out of drag.
Yes. Since I said I would get back to the pronoun question, I'll just let listeners know that I know Darcy primarily because I take his class Sexitude and he's always in boy clothes. So I'm used to calling Darcy he, but all the media coverage I've seen, it's always she. So I may slip from time to time, and Darcy is not in drag at the moment, I will just say. So here's another character you created, shoulder pad magnate Diana Midnight in your show Bitch Slap.
Midnight Enterprises owns a patent for shoulder pads, a multi-billion dollar industry, and one of the most important fashion innovations in history. You, Cassandra, hold the patent for the crotchless thong. Tasteless, vulgar, and obscene.
So how did Diana Midnight arrive in your creative mind, shall we say?
Well, I really wanted to do something that sent up the nighttime soap operas of the 80s and the ridiculousness of the soap opera plot, that really anything can happen. And I really wanted to be sort of the Joan Collins character, but I realized, you know, being the lead, there's got to be some sympathy for her. So I had to sort of create a character that was tough, but also had a softness about her. And, you know, I built in a speech impediment that really helps with a lot of the jokes. Her overly developed lips due to her extensive modeling career. So she has to have a soft ash all the time.
And prune so many times.
Well,
what's the importance of prune, may I ask?
Well, in the now time, people do the duck lips thing, and it's been said that if you say prune when you take the picture, you get the perfect duck lip. And so,
try it at home, folks.
You know, I just had so much fun doing the research of watching Dynasty and Dallas and Falcon Crest. And then, like, reading the Harlequin romances, because there's another aspect to it, that every time there's a love scene, it turns into a narrator narrating a very sort of over-the-top Harlequin romance-style text, and the actors have to act it out. And it's all done live, so there is always the danger that if the narrator decides to say something different, we have to do whatever it is. And a lot of it is built in, but it really does then create this sketch comedy aspect within the play, because if we do make a mistake or something funny happens, you can't tell what's been planned as a mistake and what is actually happening as a mistake. So it gives us a lot of freedom, but it really keeps the audience, I think, laughing, but also on their toes. So it's sort of, yeah, Dynasty meets the Carol Burnett Show in that respect.
Yeah, great. And, you know, it seems like there's a pattern here of things based on 1970s and 80s entertainment, TV, movies.
I grew up on them.
Sure, of course. And, you know, The Golden Girls has been one of the big hits that you've been in. I know you didn't write that. That in that particular one, you're basically using the script pretty much verbatim, but with a lot of hamming it up, and so that those words can be understood on a different level than perhaps they were meant, or perhaps.
Correct. I mean, we adapted, like I've adapted a number of television shows for the stage, and then there is freedom to not only change things that make more sense because you're doing it live and you're not on television, and also things that are funnier in drag. You know, there are the little subtle inside jokes and all the things, but those scripts are you know, they're made for drag in a lot of way because they still are that old school sort of slapstick, almost vaudevillian jokes that I think people are still so hungry for. I mean, that's on one level, I think people think it's not very smart comedy, or like they think all my puns are like lowbrow, but I actually think it is very smart and it's very technical. And I just look out of the audience and people are beaming. The laughter is so, you know, palpable in the room. And it's something that I feel like people really miss. And if they never had it before, it's somehow in them that they want to enjoy. I mean, I young and old, they love this kind of humor. And so Golden Girls just has that baked in. And those broads were all fabulous. And they were like, you know, the end of an era, a dying breed of those kind of, you know, those kind of comedians. And it's that kind of comedy is a little dangerous in a lot of ways. That slow burn that B. Arthur would do, it's one of those things where you keep looking and the laughter dies. And then you're there, you're stuck. And if you just keep holding it a little longer in that dangerous place, and if it works, the laughter comes back and there's a wave of laughter that's even funnier than when you started. And like I do a moment of that in Bitch Slap where there's a big explosion and they don't know if there's any survivors and the nurse leaves the stage and everyone sits there waiting. And I make her sit backstage and she waits about a minute, which just feels like 10 minutes where you're an actor on stage. And it's like, and then comes on and says, no. And it's, the joke is so funny because we pushed it so hard in that place that feels sort of dangerous. Cause like, what if it doesn't work?
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I love about that sort of old broad humor. It's, not old broads, it's broad.
Right.
It's older
right.
humor.
right. You recently revealed plans to turn Bitch Slap into a movie also. So tell us about that.
Well, my goal actually is to make it into a series. I would like to basically make my own soap opera. And I think the world is ready for a drag soap opera. I mean, seeing the response I get from the stage show, which really is one of my most successful shows, it resonates. And I think, it's endless trope. You can just keep going and going and going. And it would be really fun. And ideally, I'd love to do it where each week we'd have a guest star and I'd write a specific bit for either a drag star or a soap star. And there's plenty of them, I'm sure, would love to spoof the genre. So that is my long-term goal. I'm going to just produce it myself to start and either try and sell it or if not, do it as a web series and hope that it could get picked up on a bigger platform.
Do you think you'd try to do that in front of a live audience? Because it seems like that's so much of the feedback that makes those things work.
I mean, I think it would be really fun to have a live audience. Yeah, I mean, I do question if the comedy will be as strong if we're not having the laughs to play off of. You know, that is actually a very good question. I mean, I've been planning to go ahead and film it like you would film Dynasty with, a multi-camera shoot, but in the studio and not with an audience. I don't know. I mean, that's a very good question. I mean, and perhaps it is something that's a little more like a hybrid of a sitcom where you do have a small audience and they are there to sort of help the actors because it is hard to play to a quiet room when you're trying to land jokes. And that was one of the more interesting aspects of moving from stage to screen in the first film was the fact that you didn't get the reaction. You got to hope that the joke is landing. And then even so, I've had some sort of, in quotes, user reviews, people that have just watched it and reviewed the film. And a few people have called it like the stupidest movie they've ever seen. It's so dumb. And I think they're...
Ouch.
I know, right? Someone else called it a smut fest, which I was very proud of. But I think, you know, some people aren't getting the jokes that they're meant to be sort of idiotic, right? And it's a play on words. But without hearing an audience respond to it, I think that for some people, they might misunderstand that kind of humor.
Yeah.
In general, I think creating that genre on film versus on stage is a very, it's a hard thing when it really does depend on the reaction of the audience. And I often say, like, you know, doing that kind of theater that's almost vaudeville, or I like to call vaudeville 2.0, you rely on the audience as a character. Like, you really are a character, and their reaction and sometimes even their vocalizing of things and talking back to us is part of the process and part of what makes it so funny, because when we can react to them, there's a whole other layer of jokes that happen only right there in that moment. They'll never be there again. And that's, I think, the sort of magic of live theater and that live comedic theater like that.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you. You're hearing Out in the Bay, Queer Radio and Podcast. I'm Eric Jansen. My guest is San Francisco's and, as far as we know, the world's first drag laureate. Before we move on to what a drag laureate is and politics, I want to make it clear that Oasis is not all about Darcy Drollinger's shows. Oasis draws drag and other performers from around the U.S. and from other countries, and also features drag kings. Here's Lee Crow, whom I first knew years ago as Elvis Herselvis, playing Captain Kirk in an all-gender roles reversed recreation of the original Star Trek.
Kirk's Enterprise.
Spock here, Captain.
Report on magnetic storm.
Standard ion type, but quite violent. And unpredictable.
Rough ride.
I love Lee, and Lee is, you know, one of those people that really understands what I do theatrically, and, you know, watching their career just really span so many decades. They're one of the first people that I met here in San Francisco when I first moved here. We performed together. We met when my band at the time was playing, and Lee opened for us with her Elvis impersonation, and they're a dear friend and just a great performer.
How big a part of the mix is our drag king events?
We do quite a few drag king events, but I will also say that we just incorporate drag kings in everything. I think just sort of like how there used to be a need for all these gay or queer theater companies to exist, and I'm still happy that some do, but I think they're not as necessary anymore because we're seeing ourselves represented in more mainstream theatrical productions, for example. And so I sort of see that as, you know, drag has progressed, and we don't have to have drag nights that are just for, you know, drag queens and just for drag kings, but they can all be in the world together, and that drag is anything you want to make it, because there are drag kings and queens in our shows. There's trans performers. There are, you know, AFAB queens, AFAB kings, you know, men dressing up as men, women as women. Like, it's just taking the look and the idea of that feminine or masculine side over the top. And then there is a world in between that we're seeing, especially in San Francisco. I feel like we have the most progressive drag scene here than anywhere I've ever witnessed. And people are willing to take a lot of chances on what drag is. And so I do think it's sort of morphed into something that is much more inclusive within the drag world in terms of what we're seeing, at least on the Oasis stage. And I like to think that, you know, the Oasis, in some ways, it's a gold standard for the rest of the country. I mean, I feel like we are the largest, most drag-centric and drag-owned clubs that exist in the U.S. And a lot of that isn't necessarily super intentional. You know, the less sort of things have to be compartmentalized and we can put them all together, I think, is better for the community, for sure.
Yes, I would agree with that. So what is a drag laureate? We've heard of poet laureates whose job is to elevate the status and appreciation of poetry. So what does a drag laureate do?
You can use the exact same terminology, just throw in drag instead of poetry. I mean, I think that it's something that we're finding out what a drag laureate does. Because drag has become so politicized so suddenly in a lot of ways. I mean, I think in a lot of ways drag has always been political, back from Compton cafeteria riots and Stonewall to just the bravery of doing something that, you know, those times was illegal, right? You go to jail.
Right.
If you're wearing
right
over five pieces of the opposite sex clothing, which is so crazy to me because it wasn't.
Oh, they
that
had a number. They actually
ago.
Had a number of
yeah,
five
yeah,
pieces.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the things I was thinking about when I was preparing for this interview, this conversation, is that on some level, it's one thing to just dress the way you feel like dressing. And it's another thing, it almost feels like if you dress against the norm to some extent, on some basic core level, it's a bit rebellious.
It is. And I mean, and you feel it when you walk down the street, you know. And it's also one of those things, you feel it at first, and the more you do it, the less you feel it, right?
Right.
And it becomes not so hard to do once you're more sort of comfortable walking in the world like that. I mean, I'll say San Francisco is pretty fabulous in the way that, you know, I can go out and drag, at least in the places that I go, and light up the room and light up the street, and people want to like say hi to me and take my picture and really do appreciate it in a way that, now I know that's not going to be how it is around the country. And it's one of the things I love about San Francisco, right? But I think that because the Drag Laureate thing sprung up at the same time that everything else was happening, that, you know, my talking points were a lot more about politics versus, you know, sparkle. It's very important. I talk about this in dance class.
You sit in this room and there's so much joy right now with all of us, and we're applauding each other, and we don't even all know each other's name. And we are still celebrating, not just when we get it perfectly, but when we are just expressing ourselves and moving through the world. And the more that we can feel free to live in this space, to live in this energy, we are walking through the world really our truly authentic self. Because each and every one of us is just a little different, right? And we all have that. Everyone who is alive wants to feel this joyous and this free. And it is contagious. And if we inspire other people, I say it all the time, but there's that much less room in their hearts and their minds for anger, hostility, prejudice. We can change the world by being more fabulous. And you have that power every single day. So go out and change the f***ing world.
For me, being the Drag Laureate was just elevating what I was already doing. I was already, you know, creating space for the community to perform. I was already working, you know, with a number of different organizations to make things happen in the city. I was already sort of really embodying this idea of, if everyone is a little more authentic and more fabulous, they're busy doing that and they have less time in their hearts and their heads and for anger and hostility and prejudice. And it is amazing, the idea that we can live a more fabulous life at the exact same time we're transforming the world into a better place. And if nothing else, being able to just express that sentiment, that one sentiment, on a much bigger level, I think to me is made everything worth it, being the Drag Laureate. And there's all these other things that look good on paper, but really that ideology and embodying that in my life and as the Drag Laureate has been, you know, the most rewarding thing for me.
When you mentioned the class you teach a minute ago, you were talking about sex too.
I just
want to be sure I know. So here's San Francisco Mayor London Breed, who gave us a hint of why a Drag Laureate was important for the city, for the country, and the world when she announced your appointment last May.
The job description starts with be fabulous all the time. It also is an important part of representing San Francisco. Representing San Francisco and our values for inclusion. Making sure that people know that no matter who you are or where you come from or who you love, you have someone who has a voice that will always represent you and speak on your behalf.
Did the city give you a like formal job description, or how much of it was your free reign to create with this blank canvas?
It was a lot of that. And I think they gave me more free reign because I was so involved already in so many things. You know, there have been discussions along the way and ideas of things we want to work on together, me and with the city. I think that, you know, they're in the process of defining what it is as well, and looking at what I'm doing and what I've done when it's over will be, you know, part of understanding more of what they're going to want. I think that, you know, like Mayor Breed said, it really does show how important San Francisco is in terms of really letting the communities and the queer community have a voice in city politics and elevating us and seeing us. It's like we look from Jose Seria, from the court system that was created back in the day when the community really needed to take care of each other because people weren't taking care of each other.
We're talking about the 1950s,
yeah,
so, right?
Yeah, yeah. Into now with like the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, which are really like, they are drag nuns and they are doing what nuns do. They are raising money. They are taking care of people. I mean, that all exists still here. The court system, we have two court systems here. We've got the Drag Laureate. We've got the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. Then we have other people like, you know, Juanita Moore and other drag personas that are doing so much community work. San Francisco is a very unique place that way. And I know that, you know, we can complain about all the stuff that isn't going right. But when I sit here right now and talk about all of this, it feels rather utopic, right? Is that the right word? It's like, yeah. It's like there is a drag utopia here where the drag community gets a place at the table.
Yeah.
Like a real
place.
serious place at the table. And, you know, I mean, the mayor calls me on my cell phone. That's pretty fabulous, you know, and cares what I think, you know?
Yeah.
And so I don't know that we'll have figured out everything for the Drag Laureate when I'm done, but I do hope that I can at least create some things that could be replicated each year. Like we did the SF is a Drag, where we had 2 days of drag performances on 60 street corners, which was a very complicated thing to put together.
Bet it was.
But it came off fabulously. And like, that's something that I could see happening and being something that the Drag Laureate does and participates with. Like, I have my own nonprofit that this could go through, but maybe the Drag Laureate picks a nonprofit that they work together to, you know, sort of sponsor and co-create the SF as a Drag. And maybe someday that would turn into like the Day of Music in Paris, where everyone goes to the streets and plays music all over the city and they vie for the best corners. And what if every drag queen on the same day every year just came to the streets and just filled the streets.
And other people just got into it, just the general public.
Exactly. Right? I mean, that would be my fantasy, as if it became such a thing and people would come to San Francisco to come for the Day of Drag, where drag took over everywhere. And everyone, you know, at the coffee shops, the baristas were in drag. Everyone's in drag. Like a Day of Drag would be incredible, right? And so, you know, that's not going to happen overnight. But if it's something that is continued by the Drag Laureates in the future, maybe that's something that could blossom.
You also mentioned, I think, a drag mall.
Yes.
What did you mean by that? Any steps towards that?
Well, I have made some steps. I think a drag mall would be amazing. We have so many empty, large stores. I want to create an open air, basically an open air drag mall where I can offer booths or areas of the store for different local designers, wig stylists, and also entrepreneurs. Maybe someone wants to start selling makeup. Maybe they want to sell jewelry. Maybe they want to sell shoes. You can't buy any of that thing of those things here anymore in a place that is so known for drag, you know? And there are so many drag performers and we all have to shop online. We can't even buy dance tights anymore. All the dance stores have closed. So if we could create something that would be an important brick and mortar store for the drag community to go to and grab a pair of tights, grab some eyelashes.
Or some size 10 shoes or size 12 wide.
Exactly. And it could also be a great tourist destination for people that want to go to the drag mall, right? And maybe we could even do like glamour shots where you can get, you know, you can buy the stuff and someone will put you in drag and you can get your drag photos taken. It'd be a great place to also do like meet and greets with different drag artists, workshops on doing styling wigs, doing makeup. It could all happen in the store. And we've got all this space. So I have actually looked at two locations and working on a business plan. And I feel like if I want to make it happen, I can make it happen. And so people are, they see, you know, the artistry and what we're doing, I think, and they want it because it is fabulous and it does fill up the room with joy and sparkle. And I think I'm proud that people are seeing what we're doing and want to incorporate us and bring us into their worlds. Because I think there's a lot of room for drag in the art worlds. And I have lots of ideas and feelings about that as well.
You're hearing Out in the Bay, Queer Radio and Podcast. I'm Eric Jansen. My guest is San Francisco's, and as far as we know, the world's first drag laureate. I want to ask you about the impact across the country, perhaps. I want to play a song that I recently heard about a young woman struggling in the town where she grew up. She hated her high school. She didn't fit in with the jocks and the girls, so she split, and she found help. Here's part of Mary Gauthier's Drag Queens in Limousines.
I stole mama's car on a Sunday. I left home for good. I moved in with some friends in the city in a bad neighborhood. Charles was a dancer. He loved the ballet. Kimmy sold pot and red Kerouac and Hemingway. Drag queens in limousines, nuns in blue jeans, dreamers with big dreams. They all took me.
That's Mary Gauthier, originally from Louisiana. She released that back in 1998, so 26 years ago. And if it's about her own teenage years, then add another 15 to 20 years to that, and you have an idea of how long drag queens have been around and helping people as well as entertaining them, and not as politicized as today. So when, how, and why did drag become politicized? Especially recently, it seems to have become such a flashpoint in our country's culture wars.
Yes, it is. It is sort of been a shock, I think, to the whole community, because the feeling was that we were moving so far past this, and now we're moving backwards in such a harsh way. I mean, it's not just drag performers and trans people, and trans people are just more visible now. The same prejudice has been there. I feel like suddenly it's emboldened because of the politics we're in. I mean, I'd say the same thing for women's reproductive rights. I never thought we would be going backwards. And now they're trying to put a major federal ban, It is insane to me. So I do feel like, in some ways, these people just could never speak about it. It wasn't acceptable to be that level of prejudice or that level of misogynist anymore. And things have changed, and somehow they feel like they can be. And I can't believe that we're even having to have these conversations. I thought we had moved past it. And now I'm realizing that this is sort of the life that I'm going to have the rest of my life, is dealing with this, because this isn't going to go away overnight.
Right.
And it makes you realize how important our freedoms are, mm-hmm. and how we have to be pretty vigilant all the time to keep our freedoms, and we take for granted. And I'm in a bubble inside a bubble inside a bubble, right? I'm in the United States, I'm in California, I'm in San Francisco, I'm in the queer community in San Francisco. And it doesn't get any more sort of free as that, but it also doesn't get any more insular than that, right? Where, I can't travel around the country or the world and have these kinds of freedoms. You know, I did an interview with the BBC Global, you know, early on in the Drag Gloria time, and the amount of comments that were like hate comments, like serious hate comments, because people in other cultures that are where it's very acceptable to kill gay people, right. Let alone drag queens
and trans people,
trans people, and so you don't realize how much sort of hate there is in the world around just you existing.
Yeah.
Is. And so it's been a big bummer, but it's also, I have the freedom to like kiss whoever I want to in broad daylight on the street. I have the freedom to dress in drag and walk down the street. I have the freedom to be so much exactly who I want to be. And so if I don't take that opportunity, like, it is really a shame, because for all the people that are never going to get this opportunity, and if I'm going to not take advantage of it, like, you are not walking through the world standing up for all those people that don't get the opportunity by ignoring that opportunity when it's right in front of you. And I think we don't celebrate it enough, and we don't take advantage of it enough, because we owe it to all those people that don't.
Okay. I'll be wearing a skirt to sextude more often.
You better.
And I guess I'm going to also walk to my car in my skirt more than I usually do, because even in San Francisco, that still feels a little bit weird. I just found this today, and I was surprised, because I was checking on the status of anti-drag legislation across the United States. I knew that Tennessee was the big one that passed it last year, but also Montana and at least 15 other states have bills in progress to restrict drag performances, according to a report by the nonprofit World Population Review. Some of these laws are quite severe. Under Arizona's pending legislation, drag artists who perform in front of children under 15 years old would be subject to at least 10 years in prison and forced to register as sex offenders, says that report. But most of the states plan to appeal those rulings, so in those states, there may soon be no drag queen story hours for the kids in schools and public libraries like we have here in California, nor for anyone anywhere outside where minors might just happen to walk by.
But you can take them to a WWF wrestling match and watch people beat the hell out of each other.
And gun shows, I suppose.
Yes, sure. And I mean, you could, you know, for these under 18 kids, they can buy a gun, but they can't watch a drag queen tell a story. And I also think things like that that are, you know, they're really also coming after the parents, right? And all of these red states want less government and more personal freedom, but they only want their own personal freedom. They don't want personal freedom that they don't approve of, because really these kids aren't like running away from home to get to the library for the drag story hour, right? They're being taken there by their parents who want them to have that experience. I mean, Drag Story Hour was created by Michelle T because she wanted something special for her children, and she just did it for her kids. And it just started growing and growing and growing. And because people wanted it.
Is there anything else that you want to talk about that we haven't touched on yet?
You know, I think that it's been a really profound, you know, time with the Drag Gloria role, in sort of in conjunction with coming out of the pandemic with the nightclub and really finding a bigger, stronger voice for Oasis in terms of its place in the world, not just in San Francisco, but as a place for other performers, other kings and queens and trans performers to have a home. Drag has been something that's plopped in a bar somewhere, and you got to like turn some milk crates into a stage or dance on the pool table and change in the electrical closet or the public bathrooms. But to be able to have a space that has been created for you and your needs as a performer, with good dressing rooms and a bathroom and a closet and electricity back there, and staff that, like, you know, welcomes you, that you aren't, you know, just a stranger coming into a club, but you are coming home. And I think the more that we can create those environments for performers, it affects the performers and it also affects the audiences. And I think that is a way that we can elevate what drag is. And I also think, you know, drag is this fluid art form that is more like a lens that you can put over any other art form. And it's like when you look at something and you're used to seeing it one way, but then you look at it under a microscope or a magnifying glass, it suddenly blows it up and it looks like something completely different. And you can see parts of it that you could never see before. And I think that drag does that, where it blows up. It's larger than life. It blows up the masculine identity. It blows up the feminine identity. And you start to be able to see things in a different perspective. I think that drag has a lot to offer if people could take it more seriously.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, Queer Radio and Podcast. My guest was San Francisco Drag Laureate Darcy Drollinger. Thanks so much, Darcy, for spending so much time with us here. Learn more at darcydrollinger.com or sfoasis.com. We'll have the links on our site, outinthebay.org, too. We close our hour with a short feature on Darcy Drollinger's Sexitude dance class, which then was called Sunday School. It was produced in 2014 by then reporter and now KALW program director and Queer Power Hour host, David Boyer.
I hear people coming up the stairs. Good morning, Beatrice.
A couple dozen people gather at the Academy of Ballet. It's early, 11 a.m., and while it looks like your standard dance studio, you know, there's wall-to-wall mirrors up front and ballet bars in the back, it's clear that this is not your average dance class. For starters, there's the students.
We have people who are 60.
Doctors.
People who are obese.
Drag queens.
People who've had HIV for decades.
And then there's folks like this.
I write software which helps manage the logistics at ports.
And this.
I teach AP Calculus and Algebra 2 and Algebra 1.
And this.
I work at a really vanilla job. We actually specialize in investment management.
On the surface, they all have something in common.
I work at a place that's pretty stodgy.
And that's one of the reasons they've come here today.
It's fun to be able to just dress up one day a week at least and live the dream.
The dream is backup dancing, and their dream maker is Darcy Drollinger. You can't miss him. He's leading the warm-up in fluorescent blue spandex with hot pink socks and a headband.
I personally have a spandex addiction.
Many people here have clearly followed his lead.
I am wearing star-studded fishnet stockings with sparkly panties.
A Hanes t-shirt with hand-stenciled lettering that says, I'm a stupid bitch. A
lot of good gold lame.
Skimpy tops.
Leopard print booty shorts.
Neon colors.
A cut-off shirt with my hairy little gut sticking out.
Fringe.
And I'm fine if people come in gym shorts and a t-shirt. But if they put on a sassy flash dance top and some leg warmers, I can guarantee you they're going to dance harder and they're going to have more fun.
But don't be fooled by the outfits. This class is physically challenging and this warm-up is no joke.
And stretch. Flap back. Lié stretch. Flap back. Release sideline.
I'm not kidding. The first time I went, I could not really walk that well till Thursday.
After the class, I told Darcy, I said, oh my gosh, I can't do this. He just said, come back next week. Just keep coming back. And I did. And it got easier.
This is week 3 of this routine, so I'm going to push you a little further. And I tightened up a few things too, so you'll be happy.
Squeeze me.
The dance moves, honey. The dance moves.
So here's how it works. Darcy creates a new routine each month. He teaches it in bite-sized sections, adding new bits each week.
This little beginning part's the most complicated part of the whole thing. So once we get that under our belt, we can keep running that over and over and over and we'll add the rest of it. And I'll put some music on and we'll start working with music. 5, 6, 7, 8. Face, 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 shoulder, smooth skin, palm, palm.
Okay. Darcy demonstrates as he goes. The laser-focused students watch him in the mirror and mimic his every move. Some nail it. There's also some awkwardness. And there's a few questions. Once everybody's got it, Darcy moves on.
Boom! And I'm about to show you something gorgeous. Okay? Turn around. Boom. One. Push it out. Bring it in. Show it off. And bam. More. And bam. Hello, Webby. All right, let's try it with some music.
It's not about getting every move right every single time.
I want to see a little fire in your faces.
He pushes us to have an attitude, to be fierce.
Give me something. Sell the song to me.
It's kind of like half acting and half dancing.
You got no excuse but to seduce. 6, 7, 8.
He will often say in class,
I want sexy.
Give me sexy.
Or I want attitude.
Or give me attitude. I choose attitude over sexy. The sexy thing is still so tied up with my Catholic upbringing that sexy meant slutty.
Some of them are going to be better at tossing their hair. Some people are going to be better at, you know, the actual move. Some people are going to be better at crawling on the floor, whatever it is. You know what I mean? So using whatever strength they have.
Definitely feel glamorous. Definitely feel fabulous.
I want you to fire every muscle.
For some, muscle. Sunday school is a great way to unwind and get some exercise. But for many, the class is much more.
The class has definitely changed my life. I think I struggle with not being comfortable in my own skin. And I know this sounds kind of cliche, but he's kind of taught me how to love myself, to love who I am, to embrace who I am, and to show off who I am.
I would go crazy if I didn't get to dance. Don't get to have that type of expression anywhere else.
It seems like a lot of people in class have gotten up the courage to quit their crappy jobs after being in dance class for a while. You feel almost rebellious and you begin to get more impatient with things that don't make you feel positive about yourself. I think I understand more now why people go to church.
And for Darcy, their passion is his reward.
What is so satisfying is to watch these people when they give it their all. They give it everything they've got, and they may not be perfect, and they're probably not going to be perfect. But there's something so joyous when they are going for it in this kind of raw, enthusiastic way, purely for the joy of doing it.
You're fabulous. Have a wonderful week. I love you all. Thank
you. Our thanks to KALW for that feature on Darcy Drollinger's Sexitude dance class, produced by David Boyer in 2014. Learn more about Sexitude at sexitude.com. Instead of our usual theme music, we'll go out with Lady Champagne, featuring Zelda Kosnowski on lead vocals from the SH Blank T and Champagne soundtrack. You can hear past episodes, get in touch, and sign up for our email newsletter at outinthebay.org. While you're there, please consider chipping in. Your donation helps us keep bringing you queer voices and stories. Out in the Bay is nonprofit and independent. That means we get no financial support from most of the radio stations that air Out in the Bay, nor from NPR, nor from podcast platforms. We rely on listener support. Just hit the donate button at outinthebay.org. Thank you kindly. We did get support for this edition from KALW's Queer Story Fund, so big thanks to KALW and its director of programming, David Boyer, who also produces and hosts KALW's Queer Power Hour. Special thanks to San Francisco Public Press and its radio station, KSFP, in whose studios we recorded this edition of Out in the Bay, and especially to our studio engineer, station manager Mel Baker. David Kwan is our sound designer and audio editor. Porfirio Rangel and I co-produced this edition. Thank you, David and Porfirio. Our theme music was written and performed by Holly Mead. Thanks also to Mary Gauthier and Crit Harmon for allowing us to play their song, Drag Queens in Limousines, on this edition. And the good folks at Oasis for providing music and audio clips from Oasis Productions. I'm Eric Jansen. I'm glad you could join us out in the Bay at outinthebay.org. Wait, there's more. We recently found a new song that fits really well with our drag theme. James Taylor Jr., a queer musician from Detroit, Michigan, released Boy in a Dress in May. He calls it a heartfelt homage to the beloved cult classic film Tu Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar. Boy in a Dress reflects on the story of iconic character Miss Chi-Chi Rodriguez, who dreams of becoming a world-famous drag queen, but she is dismissed by her peers who see her not as a drag queen, but merely a boy in a dress.
It's a poignant reflection on drag culture, queerness, and the struggle for validation in today's socio-political landscape.
She's got a broken heart for every light on Broadway. She's got a broken dream for every broken road. Every journey has to start and hers begins today. She knows where she's been but not quite sure where.
That's James Taylor Jr.'s Boy in a Dress from his Pride album. Learn more at James's website, jamestaylorjrmusic.com. That's jamestaylorjrmusic.com. You can also find his music on SoundCloud and YouTube. Thanks again for listening to Out in the Bay at outinthebay.org.